Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Chand and Phil Dierking. Jill Robbins and John Russell will bring us Everyday Grammar, and later we will present our American History series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Chand.
Turkey has announced plans to move voting stations in some areas with a high Kurdish population. The government says the move is designed to stop threats against Kurdish voters. But the main pro-Kurdish party says the plan is aimed at keeping its members out of parliament in elections later this month. Turkey's High Election Board announced the plan earlier this week. The board did not say how many ballot boxes would be moved. But it noted that 144,000 voters lived in the affected areas. The pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, the HDP, said the voting stations were moved from villages where the party has strong support. The party said they are to be set up in nearby villages that support the AK party of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. It added that the move was designed to keep the HDP below a 10% threshold of votes needed to enter parliament. The move was made possible by legislation that passed in parliament 2 months ago. The law gave the election board's members permission to combine electoral areas and move ballot boxes to other areas. The government said the law was changed because of concerns that the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, could threaten voters in the mainly Kurdish southeast to vote for the HDP. The PKK is banned in Turkey. The group launched an armed campaign against the government in 1984. The board's chairman, Sadi Güven, reportedly said, "Security is important, but going to the polls with free will is also very important." Under the electoral law, Turkish officials will accept ballots that are not marked by the local electoral board. It also gives security force members permission to enter a polling station when invited by a voter. Opposition parties say the changes will make the vote counting less open. The elections are set for Sunday, June 24th. Opinion studies have shown that the HDP is likely to win about 10% of the vote. They also show the total opposition share at around 50%, making it a close race to get control of parliament. If the HDP fails to reach the threshold, its votes could be split between other parties. That probably would raise the AK party's numbers and likely guarantee it a majority. I'm Susan Chand.
The American company Walmart is offering something new to its employees, help with earning a college degree. Walmart is the largest private employer in the United States. In the past, the company has helped its workers finish high school or pass the General Equivalency Development, or GED, exam. The GED is designed to show one's knowledge of high school level skills. Walmart hopes the chance to earn a college degree will help it find and keep higher quality entry-level employees in a competitive labor market. Walmart is partnering with a company called Guild Education to offer employees the chance to get a bachelor's degree in business or supply chain management. The program will cost $1 a day at one of three nonprofit schools, the University of Florida, Brandman University, and Bellevue University. The Associated Press says all three universities have had success working with adult learners and offer programs through the internet. Walmart plans to expand its program to other degrees in the future. It will also offer college preparation classes for workers who need extra help. The company is paying for the cost of classes, books, and other school-related costs, so students will not need to borrow money. Walmart said its program is open to both full-time and part-time workers who have been with the company at least 90 days. The company expects about 68,000 of its 1.4 million U.S. employees to sign up in the first 5 years, said Julie Murphy, Executive Vice President of People at Walmart. This new partnership is an example of how large retail businesses and restaurants are under pressure to improve the skills of their entry-level workers. It comes at a time when the jobs of entry-level workers are getting more complex, partly because of the growing popularity of online sales. Two other reasons are competition from online retailer Amazon and more demanding buyers. I'm Phil Dierking.
Many English learners have spent a lot of time studying the parts of speech, adjectives, nouns, and verbs, for example. But sometimes studying the English sentence from a larger perspective is useful. One way to get a bigger view of English is to study common sentence patterns. The English language has many patterns. In the book Rhetorical Grammar, author Martha Kuhn describes 7 common sentence patterns. In other writings, she says that 95% of sentences in English fit into basic patterns. Understanding and mastering common patterns will not only help you do better on grammar tests, but improve your writing skills too. For example, here is a passage written by Ernest Hemingway, a famous American author. It comes from the short story, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. The story is one of the most famous ones that Hemingway wrote.
This is a clean and pleasant cafe. It is well-lighted. The light is very good, and also now there are shadows of the leaves.
Do you notice patterns in these sentences? If you do not recognize them, you will by the end of this report. In this installment of Everyday Grammar, we are focusing on 2 of the most common patterns in English.
Consider a line from the song Beautiful by Christina Aguilera. The line shows the foundation of most sentences in English. A sentence equals a subject or a noun phrase plus a predicate or a verb phrase. A phrase is a group of words that act as a unit. A noun phrase has an important noun, the headword noun, along with words and phrases that give more information about it. The subject of a sentence is the whole noun phrase, not just the noun. The predicate is a verb phrase with a main verb and the words and phrases that give more information about it. If you take the sentence from the Aguilera song, you can analyze it like this.
The subject is I, and the predicate is am beautiful.
In this sentence, the adjective beautiful acts as the subject complement. It describes I, the subject. So, the song lyric is the first important sentence pattern in English.
Pattern number one is subject plus be plus subject complement.
The subject complement can be either an adjective or a noun phrase. For example, consider this line from the music group Queen. In that line, the subject is we. The predicate, are the champions, contains the be verb along with a subject complement, the champions. This noun phrase is describing the subject, we.
You might find sentences that appear more complicated, but use the same basic structure. Consider this song by the Beatles. Baby, you're the rich man. Baby, you're the rich man. Baby, you're the rich man. At first, the sentence appears complicated, but the basic structure of the sentence remains the same. Subject plus be plus subject complement. The difference is that the sentence has added information, a noun that is the same as the subject of the sentence.
Baby, you're a rich man. Or, noun, subject plus be plus subject complement.
The subject plus be plus subject complement pattern is not the only pattern you will find with the verb be. Consider these two sentences.
My friends are at the concert. The test was yesterday.
In these examples, the subject and the be verb are followed by adverbials, which are, in this case, words or phrases that tell where or when. In the first sentence, the adverbial structure is the prepositional phrase at the concert. In the second sentence, the adverbial structure is the adverb yesterday. These examples show another common be structure, subject plus be plus adverbial.
Think back to the Hemingway passage from the beginning of this story.
This is a clean and pleasant cafe. It is well lighted. The light is very good, and also, now, there are shadows of the leaves.
The second sentence clearly uses a pattern one structure.
The subject is it. The be verb is. The subject complement is well lighted. The sentence is, it is well lighted.
But if you look closely, you will see every sentence in the passage uses pattern number one. Two of the sentences use conjunctions, but they still depend on the same basic pattern. Hemingway was famous for his short, declarative style. However, he did not write using basic pattern one and two sentences only. Good writers know how to make their sentences come to life. They do not write the same sentences over and over again.
I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1918, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, a truce took effect between the Allies and Germany. But not until 7 months later was a treaty signed to officially end what was known as the Great War, and the war to end all wars. Shirley Griffith and Larry West continue the story of the peace conference following World War I.
American President Woodrow Wilson was one of the chief negotiators at the conference in Paris. Throughout the early months of 1919, he struggled hard for a treaty that would result in peace with justice for all sides. Wilson demanded a treaty that provided for a new international organization. He called it the League of Nations. To Wilson, the League was more important than any other part of the treaty. Not all Americans shared Wilson's opinion. Many feared the League would take away the power of the American government to declare war and make treaties. They also agreed with the leaders of the other Allied nations. Establishing the League was less important than punishing the defeated enemy.
The other major Allied leaders at the peace conference were Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, and Premier Vittorio Otto of Italy. Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and Otto understood how much Wilson wanted the League of Nations. They used this knowledge to win Wilson's approval for other parts of the peace treaty. Wilson soon learned that to get the League, he had to compromise on many issues. For example, he had to accept British and French demands to make Germany pay all war damages. The payments added up to more than $300,000 million. Wilson also had to accept the Allied takeover of Germany's colonies.
Some of Wilson's compromises violated his belief in self-determination. This was the right of all people to decide for themselves who would govern them. One compromise, for example, gave to Japan Germany's colonial rights in the Shantung area of China. China protested the decision. It asked that control of Shantung be returned to the Chinese government. But President Wilson needed Japan's support for the League of Nations. So he accepted Japan's demand for control of Shantung. There were other violations of the policy of self-determination. These affected the people and land along the borders of several European nations. For example, 3 million Germans were made citizens of the new nation of Czechoslovakia. Millions of other Germans were forced into the newly formed nation of Poland. And Italy received territory that had belonged to Austria.
Today, most history experts agree Woodrow Wilson was correct in opposing these decisions. They say Germany's loss of territory and citizens caused deep bitterness, and the bitterness helped lead to the rise of fascist dictator Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. In East Asia, Japanese control over parts of China created serious tensions. Both decisions helped plant the seeds for the bloody harvest of World War II 20 years later. But Allied leaders at the Paris Peace Conference were not looking far into the future. As one person said at the time, they divided Europe like people cutting up a tasty pie.
After months of negotiations, the peace treaty was completed. The Allies gave it to a German delegation on May 7, 1919. The head of the delegation objected immediately. He said the treaty was unfair. He urged his government not to sign it. At first, Germany did not sign. The leader of the government refused and resigned in protest. But a new government was formed, and its leader signed the document at a ceremony at the palace in Versailles outside Paris. Finally, World War I was officially over.
President Woodrow Wilson returned to the United States after the treaty signing ceremony. He was not completely satisfied with the treaty, yet he believed it was still valuable because it established the League of Nations. Wilson's battle for the League was only half over when the treaty was signed in Europe. He had to win approval from the United States Senate. That half of the battle would not be easy.
Part of the problem was political. Wilson was a member of the Democratic Party. The Senate was controlled by the Republican Party. Also, Wilson had refused to name any important Republicans to his negotiating team at the peace conference. Part of the problem was personal. A number of senators disliked Wilson. One was Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. Lodge was the powerful chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He told a friend he never expected to hate anyone as much as he hated Wilson.
Wilson spoke before the Senate just 2 days after he returned from Europe. He urged it to approve the peace treaty. Wilson said, "The united power of free nations must put a stop to aggression, and the world must be given peace. Shall we and any other free people refuse to accept this great duty? Dare we reject it and break the heart of the world? We cannot turn back. America shall show the way. The light streams upon the path ahead and nowhere else.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee began hearings on the treaty. It heard a number of people who opposed the League of Nations. They said the League would destroy the freedom and independence of the United States. The committee completed its hearings and prepared a report for the full Senate. The report said the United States should reject the treaty unless changes were made. The committee proposed almost 40 changes.
The committee's report was a blow to President Wilson, both politically and personally. He had worked extremely hard to win Europe's support for the idea of a League of Nations. Great crowds in Paris had cheered him and his idea. Now, the Senate of his own country was about to reject it. Wilson decided he must take his case out of the hands of the people's representatives. He would take the case directly to the people themselves. He would build public support for the treaty. If enough citizens supported it, he believed, the Senate could not reject it.
President Wilson planned a speaking trip all across the country. His family and his doctor urged him not to go. They said he was still weak from a recent sickness. But Wilson refused the advice. He said the treaty was more important to him than his own life. The president left Washington in early September. He traveled in a special train. In city after city, he made speeches and rode in parades. He shook thousands of hands. At times, he suffered from a painful headache. But there was no time to rest.
Everywhere Wilson stopped, he urged the people to support the League of Nations. It was, he said, the only hope for peace. In Boulder, Colorado, 10,000 people waited to hear him. By then, Wilson was extremely weak. He had to be helped up the steps of the building where he was to speak. He made the speech. He said he was working to honor the men who had died in the war. He said he was working for the children of the world.
Wilson put all his heart and energy into his speeches. And as his family and doctor had warned, the pressure was too great. While in Wichita, Kansas, the pain in his head became terrible. He could not speak clearly. His face seemed frozen. A blood vessel had broken in his brain. Wilson had suffered a stroke. The president was forced to return to Washington. His condition got worse every day. Soon, he was unable to move. Woodrow Wilson would spend the rest of his presidency as a terribly sick man. He continued to hold on to his dreams of a League of Nations, but his dreams now filled a broken body.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.